Alone through the crack in the bedroom's heavy curtain, she stirred, her hand sliding across the cotton sheet until it found the musculature of his bare chest. She opened her eyes and smiled at him, sliding her leg toward his own and pulling herself into his embrace.
"Good morning," she purred.
Afterward, they lay side by side, Katie running her fingers over Reese's lean chest and stomach, tracing the outline of each muscle with her fingers.
"How did you manage to spend almost 20 years in the military and walk away without a tattoo?"
"That was probably my greatest accomplishment," Reese smiled.
"Ha! Let's eat. I'm starving."
After bringing in split logs and stoking the coals in the stone fireplace to take off the morning chill, they ate a breakfast of scrambled eggs and fruit before packing a lunch and heading for the mountain. Reese led the lakeside hike uphill to one of the small tributaries that fed the larger body of water. They fished each pool in the rocky creek from below, out of the trout's line of sight, working their way uphill as they went. Katie looked like she'd been born with a fly rod in her hand, the sunlight filtering through the trees and catching the long leader as it S-curved its way through the air before settling onto the water's surface. They pushed off their waders and ate their lunch in a sunny meadow, taking in the midday warmth as they drank 75 Wine Company Sauvignon Blanc from enameled metal cups. They made love under the cloudless sky before dozing on the blanket Reese had spread out on the hillside. Katie caught the first trout of the day that afternoon, a beautiful rainbow that she held up for a photo before they put it on ice in the soft-sided Yeti cooler that had carried their lunch. She caught two more fish to Reese's one as the day progressed, which led to an amusing discussion of his angling abilities. That evening, Reese drove her to one of his favorite spots on the ranch, a high vista where they sat on his tailgate drinking local microbrews as the elk herds grazed into the grassy valley below. Katie slipped on Reese's jacket as the sun fell beneath the next ridge. In the coming weeks, the bulls would begin to rut, filling the mountain air with the enchanting sound of their bugles. The young bulls were already acting the part, posturing and chasing one another half-heartedly as the mature males watched patiently from the timber. Back at the cabin, Reese pan-fried the breaded trout fillets while Katie stood at the stove beside him, preparing a dish of Brussels sprouts mixed with bacon. They selected a silver oak Cabernet from Napa Valley as Katie recounted how her skill with a fly rod had put their dinner on the table. As what was one of her best days in memory came to a close, Katie's eyes once again took in the room and came to rest on her suitor's back right hip. It had not gone unnoticed that Reese was never out of arm's reach of a weapon. Chapter 32. Flathead Valley, Montana. After two cold nights spent in the mountains, Dimitri's men were beginning to bitch. Despite their training, he had to remember that these men were street thugs, not soldiers, and were unfamiliar with prolonged physical suffering and hardship. He cursed Yvonne for not figuring out a way to bring professionals in to handle the hit. They'd camped in a patch of thick timber without even the luxury of a fire. Each morning he had led them to their overwatch position and waited for the call from Vitya that would initiate the second phase of the operation, the elimination of Rafe Hastings. They were 400 yards from the Land Rover and its sole occupant, Rafe Hastings. They watched him climb a ridge and stare through his telescope at some distant object. Dimitri studied the man through binoculars, careful not to risk any lens glare that would give away his position. He moved like one of the mountain lions that were known to inhabit the area, light on his feet yet powerful, covering rough ground swiftly and efficiently. Still, he only carried a handgun, a short-range weapon against a half-dozen men with rifles. Add in the element of surprise and their advantage of holding the high ground, and it wouldn't even be a contest. Even if their target got lucky and took out one or two of them, Dimitri's team would overwhelm him with sheer firepower. It was the Russian way. Dmitri suppressed a smile, thinking of Stalin's adage, "Quantity has a quality all its own." All they needed now was the signal to execute. Dmitri checked the sat phone for the 100th time that morning, ensuring it was powered up and had a strong signal. He resisted the temptation to call the other team and see what the holdup was, but the rules were clear. His team was not to engage until it was confirmed the first target had been terminated. What had he heard in one of the American movies he was so fond of? Terminate with extreme prejudice. Dmitri liked that. He watched the disappointment on his men's faces as their target collapsed the legs of his tripod, strapped the optic back onto his day pack, and moved toward his vehicle. It was the second day in a row that they'd had him in their sights, completely unaware of their presence, and were forced to let him slip away. How long could their luck hold out? As the rover's 2.5-liter turbo diesel engine grunted to life, Dmitri signaled the men to move back, pulling them to the concealment and relative security of the thick evergreen forest. If the signal came before tomorrow morning, they would move as quickly as possible overland and hit him at home. Doing so would give up many of their tactical advantages, but it would be their only option. The order to kill would come soon enough. Chapter 33, Coomba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. It was Sunday before Reese was finally willing to share Katie Buranek with the Hastings family. Rafe's mother Caroline had arranged a lunch to welcome Reese's friend to the ranch, and attendance was non-negotiable. Reese and Katie went on a long hike that morning, and Katie, who was raised to never show up at someone's home empty-handed, took the opportunity to gather wildflowers that she'd assembled into an impressive arrangement of glacier lily, clematis, and purple asters upon their return to the cabin. "Awful quiet over there," Reese said as they made the short drive up to the main house. "After all you've told me about his family, from the Rhodesian Bush Wars to the Celis Scouts and everything they've accomplished in this country, I'm more excited than anything else. And Rafe's father-in-law is Senator Tim Thornton, of all people. I feel like we are going to meet royalty."
"They will be more intrigued by you and your family's story. Nothing to worry about. Besides, Jonathan is probably already drunk."
"Ha, okay. My kind of people."
As they rounded the corner toward the homestead, the lake and dock came into view, the Grumman Albatross rocking gently at its mooring.
"Whose plane is that?" Katie asked in astonishment.
"That's Thorne's. He flies it in from one of his surrounding properties in Montana or Idaho. He's here for opening day tomorrow morning. He hasn't missed one since..." Reese paused. "Since his wife died."
They pulled up in front of the house and Katie let Reese open the door for her. She was pleasantly surprised when he took her arm in his as they walked toward the home's sprawling front porch, the simple gesture helping put her at ease. Jonathan and Caroline greeted the couple with genuine joy, both hugging her before she could get through the door. True to his reputation, Jonathan held a green bottle of Namibian Windhoek Lager in his paw and handed another to Reese as he entered the foyer. A man who reminded her a bit of an older Indiana Jones rose from a leather chair by the fireplace and extended his hand.
"Ms. Buranek, Tim Thornton, I am very pleased to meet you."
"It's an honor to meet you, Senator."
"Please call me Thorn. I much prefer that. Senator conjures up too many memories of my time in the swamp," he said, referring to Washington's unofficial moniker. "And thank you for your series of articles and the book on the Benghazi mess," he continued, shaking his head. "Those boys deserve better. Politicians in and out of uniform left them to die. But enough unpleasantness. Let's get you a drink."
"What can I offer you, Katie?" Caroline Hastings asked. "What are you having, Mrs. Hastings? Please call me Caroline. I'm having champagne. That sounds wonderful."
Jonathan appeared with a crystal flute of France's finest and handed it to their guest.
"We have one other surprise for you both," he said. "Liz, would you be a dear and join us?"
Reese's eyebrows arched in amazement as all 5 feet 4 inches of Elizabeth Riley appeared from a back guest room. The two had first met in Iraq during the height of the insurgency. Riley's OH-58 Kiowa had been shot down in Najaf, her capture and torture seemingly inevitable. A few blocks away, Reese's sniper team was set up in an overwatch position of a heavily IED'd stretch of road. Hearing the situation on the radio, Reese defied orders and launched a hastily organized rescue, putting the aviator deeply in his debt. She recovered from her injuries, but was medically retired from the Army. She became like a sister to Reese and his late wife, Lauren, and a close aunt to their daughter, Lucy. Riley was unflinchingly loyal to her friends, and when Reese needed help avenging the deaths of Lauren and Lucy, she was there on wings. "Liz, what are you doing here?" Reese asked after a strong embrace.
"I work for Thorne now," she replied in her thick southern accent. "He has more planes than he can keep track of."
"Liz, you remember Katie?"
"Of course, we've kept in touch. It's not every day you spirit a kidnapped reporter off Fisher's Island in a pilatus in the middle of the night."
The two women embraced like old friends.
"Come out and have a seat. Caroline has everything set up out back," Jonathan said, leading his guests through the home and onto the back deck via the open French doors. A long table flanked with wicker chairs had been set up on the back lawn overlooking the lake. The table was covered with a flawless white starched tablecloth of fine linen and place settings of the family's best English silver and bone china were located at each seat. Brightly colored fresh flowers, now including the ones that Katie had brought, overflowed from a vase at the table's center. Jonathan had just pulled out a chair for Katie when Rafe and Annika came strolling across the lawn.
"Katie, I'd like you to meet my friends, Rafe and Annika Hastings." She rose, shaking hands with Rafe.
"So nice to meet both of you. I've heard so much about you."
Annika hugged her warmly.
"We're just glad that you were real, Katie. I was beginning to think that you were a figment of Reese's imagination," Rafe said with a grin.
"We promise not to scare you off, Katie,"
Annika added, elbowing her husband in the ribs.
"Please, everyone sit,"
Caroline said, before taking her seat at the far end of the rectangular table from Jonathan. Both younger couples sat beside one another, arranged so the women could chat at one end of the table while the men gathered at the other. Jonathan and Caroline brought the meal out in courses, each with an appropriate wine pairing. Rafe drank sparingly. Opening day of archery season was the following morning, and he had work to do. Reese and Katie had no such obligations. They both joined in the festivities with Thorne, Liz, and the elder Hastingses, enjoying the fine South African vintages.
"Don't be afraid to try my famous hot sauce," Jonathan reminded the table. "Goes great with everything."
"Don't believe him," Rafe warned. "He makes it with homegrown ghost peppers. If you value your taste buds, you'll shy away."
The conversation was light and jovial, much of it surrounding humorous stories from Reese's and Rafe's younger days.
"Does Katie know about your crazy Alaskan adventure, Reese?"
Jonathan prodded.
I don't think I've mentioned it yet," Reese responded.
"Alaskan adventure?" Katie asked.
"Yeah, how long did that insane escapade take you?" Rafe teased.
3 months, wasn't it?"
64 days,
Reese responded, shaking a finger at his friend.
"Oh, do tell,"
Katie pushed.
"I'll tell you,"
Jonathan jumped in, ever the storyteller.
"Your man here, Katie, he decides he wants to spend some time in Alaska before he ships off for boot camp. His father, Tom, God rest his soul, had a trapper's cabin in the middle of nowhere up there, so Reese had a bit of experience in austere conditions, but of course he wanted to take things to the next bloody level. He decides he wants to trek across, what was it, Reese, the Talkeetna Glacier?"
"Close,"
Reese smiled, looking sideways at Katie.
"Doesn't matter," Jonathan continued. "This wild bloke decides he's going to head into the Alaskan wilderness alone. Trek across the Talkeetna Glacier to the, what river was it? No matter, to some glacial river, and then kayak to the ocean."
"Kayak?" Katie asked. "Where was he going to find a kayak in the middle of the backcountry?"
"Ha! That's the best part, Katie," Jonathan went on.
He pulled it behind him over the snow.
You did what?
Katie asked, turning her attention back to Reese.
Well, I had it tied to me, so if I fell in a crevasse, the idea was that the kayak would slide over the top and I'd be suspended underneath. Then I'd just Jumar up and continue on.
Jumar?
Katie asked. Ascenders, they allow you to pull yourself up a rope. You can use a smaller piece of line and make your own as well.
Bis parties, Jonathan said, jumping back into the story. This was before cell phones and set phones and constant connectivity. He tells us and his parents that he'll be back in a month. 64 days later, he comes kayaking into Cook Inlet, none the worse for wear, other than looking like a vagrant.
Reese shrugged. It was a good pre-buds workout.
And that wasn't the end of it, Jonathan continued. This mountain man then sells his whitewater boat and mountaineering gear, buys a sea kayak, and spends a month island hopping his way around Prince William Sound.
What did you eat? Katie asked.
I pulled a lot of the staples behind me in the kayak, potatoes and rice, and I hunted and fished my way across for protein. I had a little .22 in the kayak that I'd use for squirrels and beavers, and a fly rod for trout and Arctic grayling. Once in the sound, I trolled off the kayak for salmon.
I'm surprised you didn't starve to death. Remember, I've seen your fishing abilities, Katie joked.
Laughter was a near constant around the table, with Jonathan having an amusing tale to tell about everyone there. As the early evening dinner wore to a close and the air temperature began to drop, the men moved to the fire pit, while the women moved inside. Thorn packed a pipe, knowing his friend would like nothing more than to roll a fresh tobacco cigarette, yet with Caroline so close he wouldn't dare. When the old war horses started discussing their plan for the following day, Reese and Rafe stepped a few feet away. Rafe not wanting the scent of tobacco to negatively impact the next day's hunt.
Good luck tomorrow, Reese said.
Thanks, buddy. If you're around, I may need help packing the meat out.
Well then, I changed my mind. I hope you don't get him, Reese chuckled.
I'm planning to take Katie into town in the morning, but we'll zip back if you need me.
Reese, his friend began, what were you looking at during dinner?
What do you mean?
You know what I mean. At times you were here, but you weren't really here.
Reese had forgotten how well his blood brother knew him.
Nothing.
Well, not nothing. Just a feeling. Something's not right.
Something's always not right, brother,
Rafe offered, scanning the distant tree line.
Remember what your dad used to tell us.
Trust your instincts, Reese recalled.
After everything you've been through, don't let the past ruin your today,
Rafe said wisely, nodding toward the main room where Katie sat with the rest of the family.
Remember what your dad used to tell us?
Reese responded in kind, nodding toward the weathered old Celis scout.
He's always full of what he thinks is good advice.
Reese's eyes narrowed, and his head turned back toward the shadows.
He said it's not paranoia if they're really hunting you.
Part 2. The Stalk. Civilized men are more discourteous than savages because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing. Robert E. Howard, The Tower of the Elephant. Chapter 34. St. Petersburg, Russia. The strain was beginning to wear on Gray, who had scarcely left his desk in days. The plan was contingent upon Reese leaving the ranch, yet he hadn't left the property in 72 hours. Changing the operation at this stage was a recipe for disaster and would require breaking his self-imposed ban on active electronic communications. Remembering what the duo had done to his mentor and handler with an RPG-32, Gray was beginning to worry. Svetlana made her nightly visit before her departure, tea in hand. This time, however, she carried a cup for herself, which was a first. She set a cup down in front of Gray, who sat at his desk, staring intently at both computer screens before him. He looked up at her with exhausted eyes and snapped his laptop shut. There was something different about her tonight.
I brought you some tea, Oliver. Thank you. I see you have some for yourself. May I offer you a touch?
Gray lifted the vodka bottle from his drawer.
That would be wonderful, Oliver.
He poured a finger of the clear liquid into her cup and filled his own to the brim, sipping tentatively to test the temperature.
Why do you work so hard? What is it that can't wait until tomorrow?
Something very important. Something that will make them fear me.
Anyone who knows how smart you are should fear you.
The Americans think that they are so powerful that they fear no one.
Ah, you will show them, Oliver.
She took a long pull from her own cup and set it down, rising from the chair and walking behind the small man. Her scent filled his nostrils as she began to massage his shoulders with her powerful hands, releasing the tension that had built up over the preceding days. Her hands worked their way up the back of his neck and onto his head, where her fingers made tiny circles on his temples. He let his head fall back with a sigh and closed his eyes. Svetlana leaned forward, pushing her ample bosom into contact with his head, and began rubbing his chest. She smiled as she saw the front of his trousers rise. Gray opened his eyes when she swiveled the desk chair so that he was facing her, his body tensing as she ran her hand to his groin.
Such a big, strong boy. No, Svetlana, I can't. Svetlana will take care of everything. You be a good boy.
She pulled open her blouse, exposing her breasts, which Gray immediately began to grope and kiss. She pulled her skirt up and sat on his lap, breathing heavily in his ear as she ground herself into him. He gasped audibly and his body quivered and lurched forward, nearly knocking Svetlana from the chair.
I'm sorry. I...
He pushed her from his lap, a dark stain visible on the leg of his tailored slacks. Unable to look at her, Gray stood uncomfortably for a moment before hurrying from the room. Svetlana did not hesitate. She pulled a USB drive from the pocket of her skirt and quickly inserted it into the port on his laptop. She walked to the office door and stole a look down the hallway. A small LED on the drive flashed red as the device downloaded the contents of the computer's hard drive. Svetlana walked out to her own desk and shuffled around as she kept an eye toward the restrooms. Picking up her phone, she sent a text message before dropping it back into her purse. When she heard footsteps in the hallway, she returned to Gray's office and palmed the USB drive. She was straightening his chair when he returned, his eyes averted. She wrapped him in a warm hug, holding his face to her chest.
Good night, my sweet Oliver.
She kissed the side of his head and walked from his office. That evening, a young man rang the doorbell at her apartment. When she answered, he handed her a bag of carryout food. Inside a wad of paper money, Svetlana passed him the USB drive. Within an hour, the contents of the drive were being exploited by a trusted team of technicians from Directorate 1 of the SVR, the Office of Russian Intelligence that specialized in digital forensics and cyber exploitation. Chapter 35. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. By the time Alexander Zharkov reached his desk at 8 o'clock a.m., the report from St. Petersburg was already in his inbox. His attention was diverted by a mild crisis in Damascus that morning, so he didn't get a chance to open the document until the afternoon. The cover sheet summarized the raw intelligence and made reference to both the source of the information as well as some of the more relevant documents recovered from the subject's hard drive. Svetlana had performed beautifully, just as he'd known she would. The Russian intelligence services were the best in the world when it came to manipulating subjects using sex, and the psychological analysis of Oliver Gray had been spot on. Alexander had pulled in all information on Gray going back to the original paper files when he was first spotted, assessed, and developed by the Soviet-era GRU before his recruitment by the late Vasily Andreyev. It was always amusing to Alexander when he saw state documents marked with stars, hammers, and scythes.
the pseudo-religious emblems of communism. Upon their re-examination of Gray's records, the SVR's psychoanalytical team had come up with a secondary diagnosis, one that went deeper than the obvious father issues. As a result of his father's absence and eventual abandonment, his mother had overcompensated and inadvertently created an unhealthy relationship with her son. He was unable to connect with women his own age or younger because deep down, he still hungered for a mother. Svetlana had been successful in earning Gray's trust and bringing his repressed gerontophilia to the surface. Alexander had placed Svetlana, one of his most experienced assets, into his father's business more than a decade ago, and she had consistently provided him with accurate, timely, and relevant updates on the activities of his father and brothers ever since. He double-clicked on a PowerPoint file titled Montana Op Ord and began scanning the pages. He quickly realized that the operation in question had already been put into motion. He scrolled to the profile on the targets. He recognized the name of Lieutenant Commander James Reese, U.S. Navy, retired, immediately, thanks to the widespread media coverage of his attack on a ring of conspirators responsible for the deaths of his family and SEALs under his command. The SVR had actually tried to locate Reese after his disappearance in an attempt to recruit him and offer him the chance to defect, but had been unsuccessful in tracking him down. Alexander also knew that Reese was suspected in the death of former Russian intelligence official Vasily Andrenov, though nothing had been proven. It was obvious from the intelligence package that his father's new asset had organized a Bratva hit team to kill James Reese, either in retaliation for the Andrenov assassination or before Reese could mount an offensive of his own against Gray. The second target was more of a mystery. Rafe Hastings, also a retired SEAL officer, was a resident of western Montana. The African-born Hastings owned an outfitting business and had made a name for himself as a builder of fine custom hunting rifles. Hastings was apparently married to the daughter of a billionaire oil and gas man who'd previously served in the U.S. Congress. Could it be him? Alexander, ever the hunter, was an avid reader of outdoor magazines published around the globe. He had become mildly obsessed with a columnist who wrote occasionally under the pseudonym of S. Rainsford, a nod to the protagonist of Richard Connell's 1924 short story, The Most Dangerous Game. The columns were the author's first-hand accounts of his solo Montana backcountry hunts, told in brilliant detail. Unlike most of the glorified advertising that passed as outdoor journalism these days, whoever Rainsford was, he was a hunter. Alexander pulled up the background check via Russian intelligence channels he'd requested a few months back. They had failed to identify an S. Rainsford, but had compiled a list of 24 possibles. Rifle maker and hunting outfitter Rafe Hastings was on that list. Alexander leaned back in his chair and tilted his head toward the ceiling.
S. Rainsford. Now he would be a formidable adversary. Adding his friend James Reese to the draw would be the hunt of a lifetime.
Alexander had once managed to attract a famous hunter from the States to hunt brown bear with him on the Kamchatka Peninsula. Despite the way he was portrayed in his articles and television series, the man was actually hopeless without a guide. When Alexander turned the tables and made him the prey, he wept and begged before becoming desperately lost. His ineptitude and lack of spirit took almost all of the pleasure out of the hunt. Alexander had seen better woodsmanship from Moscow prostitutes than he had from the overweight American.
Rainsford and Lieutenant Commander Reese would be fighters. Finally, a challenge.
Alexander made his decision. He pulled an aging paper Rolodex from his desk drawer and searched for a number that he hadn't dialed in ages.
Chapter 36. Coomba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. The sun would rise at 6:55 a.m. Rafe had been awake since 4 a.m. He turned off his alarm so as not to disturb his pregnant wife and slipped out of bed. He sipped black coffee as he dressed in a light wool shirt and pants, pulled on a knit stocking cap, and laced his buffalo hide Courtney boots. Everything he wore was designed for maximum mobility and stealth. With the prospect of running into a grizzly bear, a real one, Rafe slipped his inherited 1911 handgun into the leather holster behind his right hip. He remembered his dad's joke about 45 caliber pistols and giant predators. "Why do you file off the front sight of your 1911 when going into bear country?" his father had asked. "So it doesn't hurt as much when the grizzly shoves it up your ass." Rafe had never found it very funny. It was only a 10-minute drive from his home. He made the trip with just his parking lights on so as not to spook game or ruin his night vision. He donned his pack, picked up his recurve bow and quiver, and stood silently in the darkness to acclimate himself to the sounds of the pre-dawn morning and confirm the speed and direction of the light breeze. The morning was cool, but there was no frost. Satisfied, he began the hike toward his glassing spot. He wanted to be in position to observe the buck well before the first rays of light illuminated the valley. With practiced efficiency, he climbed the steep grade, the simple tire soles of his boots legendary for quiet stalking. At 40, Rafe was in the best shape of his life, and given the field in which he'd spent the early part of adulthood, that was saying something. The sky was just starting to lighten to the east, the nighttime display of stars washed away by the first rays of sunlight. He set himself up for a long morning of glassing, arranging his tripod and spotting scope before pulling an apple from his pack. He took a bite as he swung the powerful scope toward the buck's lair, its coated German lenses gathering every bit of ambient light. The buck should have been out feeding on the mountainside at this point in the relative safety of the darkness, but there was no sign of him. He pulled up his binoculars and began to scan, trading magnification for the wider field of view. Nothing. The slight change in temperature would not be enough to move the animal from his summer range, so that wasn't it. It wouldn't be the first time that he'd watched an animal for weeks only for it to disappear the moment that the hunting season opened. Prey species seemed to have a sixth sense when it came to the hunt. Rafe thought about his conversation with Reese the previous evening and took an extra moment to survey the high ground behind him before turning his attention back to the scope. As the sky turned from gray to pink, it became increasingly obvious that the buck had left his hide. Something had spooked him. Wolves, maybe? It was conceivable. Poacher? Not out of the realm of possibility. Rafe needed to adapt. The wind was still light but steady, and the thermals wouldn't be much of a factor this early in the day. It was time to move. The son of Rhodesia packed his spotting scope and picked up his bow before setting out quietly down the draw. Rafe's tracking mentor had been a master. Melusi was a member of the Matabele tribe, a Bantu offshoot of the powerful Zulus. The Matabele people were defeated in battle by the Dutch Afrikaners and were effectively banished to what is now Zimbabwe. Like all great African trackers, Melusi spent his childhood tending the herd, responsible for protecting the family's cattle, sheep, and goats from neighboring tribes or predatory animals. With no fences to contain their herds, Melusi and his peers would spend their days tracking each wandering animal by its spoor. It was a tremendous responsibility to place upon a child, but Melusi had a nearly supernatural gift for reading the ground and quickly took to his job. Melusi had taught Rafe to read sign from a young age, in much the same way he was taught by his own elders. One of Melusi's favorite tricks was to take Rafe to a salt lick, where animals of various species would gather to consume the valuable mineral. Melusi would squat in silence, smoking a hand-rolled cigarette, while Rafe pointed out each individual animal's tracks. He would nod as Rafe called out each name in English, Shona, and Undibili. By age 6, Rafe could tell a waterbuck track from that of a kudu, and before he was 8, he could tell the age of a track to within a few hours. He was able to read animal spoor in the wilderness the way an urbanite used street signs. Rafe's tracking skills had brought more than a few Taliban and Iraqi insurgents to an untimely end, and had earned him the respect of the hunting guides with whom he worked. The buck's sign was everywhere thanks to the many weeks he'd spent sleeping, eating, urinating, and defecating in the immediate area. Rafe made increasingly widening circles, searching for a track that led away from the site. He found it on the uphill side of the bedding spot, near the rock slide that made up the ridgeline. He saw the deep impressions of the buck's hooves as he hopped in the manner unique to an alarmed mule deer. Something had spooked him. Rafe hadn't seen any wolf or grizzly sign in the area, nor had he heard any wolves howling recently. No one other than family or friends had permission to be on the property, so he shouldn't have been startled by another hunter. Rafe took a seat and glassed the surrounding terrain, looking for any sign of what might have spooked the deer. After nearly 30 minutes of searching, he picked up his bow and began to follow the trail. Even a good tracker would have lost him in the rocks, but Rafe's skill had long since progressed beyond simply good. He went to his hands and knees and was able to make out the disturbed lichen on the rocks. Once over the knife edge of the ridgeline, the animal's path took it through the thick summer grasses, where his trail was more visible to the trained eye. It was difficult to tell how long the tracks had been there, but he estimated that they were at least a few hours old. The stems of grass were beginning to return to their natural position after being folded downward by the buck's passing. Rafe stood back up. He was on the stalk.
Chapter 37. Central Intelligence Agency, Langley, Virginia. Vic Rodriguez dialed Reese's number for the 5th time, and as usual, it went straight to voicemail. He'd received an emergency call that morning from Craig Flynn, a retired CIA officer who had previously served as the Moscow station chief. Flynn had been contacted by a senior official in the Russian SVR named Alexander Zharkov, whom he had known from his Moscow posting but had not heard from in years. Director Zharkov claimed to have come across information on a Russian mafia operation underway in Montana to kill James Reese and Rafe Hastings. Due to the time-sensitive nature of the intelligence, he said there was not time to go through official channels. Because of Flynn's history with Director Zharkov, he assessed the information to be credible. Flynn had worked with Reese's father in an operation to extract a doctor from Czechoslovakia during the Cold War, so he instantly recognized the name James Reese. Though now retired, Flynn still had close connections at Langley, including the director of the Special Activities Division. Changing tactics, Vic hit the intercom button on his phone.
Valerie, connect me to the Flathead County Sheriff's Department in Montana.
Reese showered and made the necessary preparations to keep his promise to take Katie into town. The plan was to have a late breakfast, walk around a bit, and decide whether to stay in town for lunch or get something for the road and head over to Glacier National Park. Clouds had moved in overnight. Fall seemed to be kicking at the door. They each carried a mug of Black Rifle's finest coffee as they left the cabin and climbed into Reese's Land Cruiser. Katie was even trying hers, spruced up the way Reese took his, with local honey and a bit of cream. She found it endlessly amusing that the tough commando liked his coffee a bit on the sweet side. Making the turn onto the paved highway, Reese thought back to his conversation with Thorne a couple of weeks ago and with Rafe the previous evening. It just might be time to start a new chapter, one that did not involve U.S. intelligence covert action programs. It might be time to start a new life with Katie. For Dimitri and his team, watching Rafe Hastings move into and out of his daily glassing spot had become routine. At any point, they could have initiated the ambush, but until word came from Vitya, all they could do was observe. Today was different. He'd arrived far earlier than normal. The men watched as he readied his gear by the light of his headlamp before leaving the vehicle. Then, instead of looking through his scope for a few minutes and returning to his truck, Hastings packed his gear and moved into the valley that he'd so painstakingly observed under the team's watchful eye. Dimitri also noticed that he carried a different weapon today, an ancient-looking bow with a small quiver of arrows. One man with a bow, against six with rifles. He'd watched his share of American Western films on television to know how those odds had worked out for the Indians. Dimitri stared at the sat phone, willing it to ring. He didn't know where the target was going, but sooner or later he would return to his Land Rover. When he did, they would be waiting. The sun rose, and the valley was soon bathed in an orange glow. He thought of the gray walls of his prison cell back home, the screaming, the blood. The phone vibrated. He answered it and listened as Vitya informed him that they would be initiating their ambush in just a few minutes. He'd grown to like the man and was appreciative of the heads up. There was a decision to make. Should he wait here for Hastings to return? What if the attack raised the alarm and the American military or police came with their helicopters? No. He needed to move in on the target and take him out. It was time. Dimitri slipped the phone into his pack and pulled it on over his shoulders as he stood. His men didn't need to be told to do the same, and soon they were all patrolling past Hastings's vehicle, six abreast. Hastings had a head start of several hours, but was surely trekking slowly as he stalked whatever prey he was after. Dimitri only hunted men. It felt good to be moving after so much waiting. His legs felt strong as he climbed the ridge, the rifle light in his hands. Dimitri watched his men with pride. Dressed in surplus American camouflage uniforms and moving with speed and discipline, they could almost pass for soldiers. He called a halt as they approached the first ridge, and he crept carefully forward to reconnoiter the next valley. He could see the marks where the legs of Hastings's tripod had dug into the soil, and he raised his binoculars to scan the space below him. Satisfied that the target had gone ahead, he waved his men forward. Vitya saw the vehicle move on the screen and quickly dialed Tanya using the burner cell phone that he'd brought along for the occasion. The signal was good on the high ground, and she answered after three rings. They spoke in English.
Hello? Is Dan there? I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
My apologies.
He pressed the end button, terminating the call. He whistled, getting his men's attention quickly. Their chronic boredom quickly became excitement as they moved down into their prepared ambush positions near the road. Vitya and the rest of his four-man assault team were situated on the long side of the L, with the two-man support by fire element carefully crossing the road to a position perpendicular to the target vehicle's route. When he slowed the SUV to make the turn, Vitya would initiate the ambush with the IED. The vehicle would take fully automatic fire from the front and side, with 180 rounds in the first volley alone. No one in an unarmored vehicle would survive it. Vitya watched the iPad impatiently as the target drove along the ranch roads. Just as it turned onto the highway, Tanya pulled up in her blue 2003 Jetta. She parked the vehicle on the road's narrow shoulder and, as she'd been instructed, popped the hood. She stood helplessly in front of the vehicle, wearing yoga pants and a tight tank top, hands placed on her hips. Assuming that chivalry was not yet dead in this northwestern part of the country, they were counting on their targets stopping to assist the attractive motorist in apparent distress. Vitya watched the red dot accelerate on the asphalt highway and knew from experience that it would be in the kill zone in less than 5 minutes. He moved the selector switch on his AKM to the Cyrillic marking for full auto, and set it down on the bed of pine straw beside him. Pulling the M57 firing device from his pocket, he connected it to the trailing end of the wire that led to the Claymore Mine's blasting cap. Only the small wire safety bale stood between the device's handle and a catastrophic explosion. He looked at each of the men on the assault team and received nervous but ready nods from them. He couldn't see the camouflaged figures of his second element, but was confident that they were in place. Everyone knew their jobs. Vitya looked at his watch. He needed to give Dmitri a heads up that the ambush was about to be initiated. Even in the unlikely event that their communications were being monitored, there wouldn't be enough time for anyone to stop them. He pulled the sat phone from his pouch and pressed the preset key that would place a call to Dmitri's identical unit. He held the device to his ear as he waited for it to connect to the satellite in orbit. Once the call went through, Dmitri answered almost instantly.
Yeah? We will initiate in 5 minutes. Be ready.
Understood.
Looking back at the iPad, he saw that the target was 2 minutes out. He fiddled nervously with the mine's firing device, shifting it from one hand to the other. He heard the high-pitched whine of a diesel motor climbing the rise, and a shot of panic gripped his chest. Rhys didn't drive a diesel. The driver let off the accelerator as the vehicle crested the rise, and a blue flatbed F-250 pickup rolled into view. Whoever was driving had seen Tanya and was rolling to a stop in the kill zone. The driver pulled onto the shoulder opposite her Volkswagen and left the truck idling as he stepped down onto the pavement. A tall, mustached man in his 50s and wearing jeans, boots, and a denim jacket approached Tanya, no doubt offering his assistance. They were too far away for Vitya to hear their conversation. Her body language told the story. She dismissed the man with a wave of her hand, no doubt telling him that help was on the way. The man lingered persistently. Whether it was out of a genuine desire to help or because of Tanya's tank top did not matter to Vitya. He needed this cowboy to get the hell out of the way. His eye moved back to the iPad, where the dot rounded the final bend before it would make its way up to the hill where they waited in ambush. This changed nothing. He would blow the mine and initiate the ambush, no matter what. Rhys gripped the wheel with both hands as he steered up the steep grade ahead, driving slower than normal so as not to alarm his passenger. He let up on the gas pedal and let the cruiser coast over the rise. Spotting two vehicles pulled off the side of the road ahead of him. From a distance, it looked like a female with car trouble and a man who'd stopped to help. It was nice to be back in a place where people actually cared about their fellow citizens. On cue, his iPhone came alive with the various indicators of the modern age as he entered the service area. Ordinarily, he would sneak a look at his phone to see whether there were any messages from Katie, but with her by his side, there was no reason. She had a real job and was far more accustomed to living in a connected world and, despite enjoying a well-needed respite from life's distractions, she fished her phone from her purse when she heard it come alive. Rhys was taken by surprise when the phone actually began to ring through the vehicle's hands-free Bluetooth system. Private number showing up on the LCD screen on the dash. Rhys pressed the screen to decline the call, not interested in talking to anyone who wasn't currently riding with him. The phone rang again, and that sixth sense he'd been trying to ignore all morning forced him to answer it. He pressed the green icon to answer the call. Hello?
Rhys, it's Vic. Where are you?
Despite their history, receiving a personal call from the head of the CIA's Special Activities Division wasn't exactly routine. Rhys leaned slightly forward in his seat.
I'm in Montana, heading into town. What's happening? No time to explain. There's a Russian mafia plan to hit you and Rafe Hastings. It's happening today.
Rhys looked at the cars parked beside the road and considered the sharp curve ahead. He slammed on the brakes, sending Katie forward until her progress was arrested by the seatbelt. The jolt slung her phone out of her hand, and it crashed into the floorboard at her feet.
"Get down!"
Rhys yelled, pushing her head down below the dashboard. He put the cruiser in reverse, and the powerful engine revved as the tires spun, finally catching as the SUV lurched to the rear. Smoke billowed from the off-road tires as Rhys executed a textbook J-turn, sliding the vehicle from reverse to forward in a fraction of the time it would take to make a three-point turn. The rear window of the cruiser exploded in a shower of tempered glass as a burst of 7.62mm rounds from a member of the support element raked the back of the vehicle. Rhys pushed his foot to the floor and took advantage of all 430 horses as he sped away from the kill zone.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, looking at Katie for any sign of injury.
"What?
Are you hit?"
"No, I don't think so. What was that?"
"You just survived your first ambush."
"My first?"
she asked, thinking back to the time that a taxi driver had opened fire on the two of them on a Los Angeles sidewalk.
"Good point. You're second."
"Rhys, you okay?"
It was Vic's voice coming through the speakers.
"Yes, sir."
"You with Rafe?" "No, I'm with Katie."
"Roger that."
The phone lost signal as they drove down the hill at almost 100 miles per hour. "Katie, I need you to reach behind the seat. There's a rifle mounted to the back of it. Grab it and put it next to me." Katie unbuckled and turned around, returning with the rifle that Rafe had put in the truck for his friend, just in case. Rhys knew it was loaded, but took his right hand off the steering wheel to perform a quick press check. He slid it to where he could access it quickly and, without looking, turned the knob on the left side of the scope to illuminate the reticle. He reached for the radio mic hanging on the dash and pressed the talk button. "Rhys for Rafe, over." Static. "Rafe. Rafe, come in, over." Nothing. "Rhys to Kumba Base, over. Rhys to anyone on this channel, this is an emergency, over." No response. Rafe was too far from the main road to hear the gunfire, and they were too far from the ranch to be in radio range. It would take them a few minutes until they were inside the repeater network that allowed the ranch staff to maintain contact while on the property. Rhys pushed the cruiser to the maximum speed that its low gear ratio would allow, the knobby tires propelling them back toward Kumba. Chapter 38. St. Petersburg, Russia. Gray stared excitedly at the screen of his desktop, watching the signal from the Iridium GPS indicator steer toward the ambush site. It wouldn't be long now. Svetlana had made an excuse not to stay late, which suited him just fine. He couldn't stomach the embarrassment of his recent performance and pushed his sexual attraction for her to the back of his mind. He felt a tinge of jealousy for the men who would send Rhys to his grave, men who had no grievance with the SEAL commander. To Gray, it was personal. While to these men, who would get to see the action up close, it was a professional job. The dot made its way to the highway, and Gray shifted nervously. He crossed and uncrossed his legs and wrung his sweaty palms. The dot finally began to climb the hill. He rose to his feet, pushed his chair backward, and leaned forward with his hands on the desk. The dot moved to the top of the terrain feature and began to slow. Then it stopped. He willed the dot forward, first silently and now vocally.
"Go! Go! Move forward! Keep going!"
The dot began to move backward, first slowly and then more rapidly away from the well-laid ambush.
"No! No!"
Gray snatched the phone from its cradle on his desk and dialed the number from the post-it note on the side of his monitor. It took forever to connect, and then rang several times before there was an exasperated answer in English with a thick Russian accent.
"What?
What happened?"
Gray shouted.
"I don't know. Some cowboys stopped to help right in the kill zone. Then the target stopped and took off."
"Did you fire?"
"Not until he drove away."
"Shit!
What do you want us to do?"
"Call the other team and tell them to execute. Move to the ranch house. Kill the primary target. Wait, just kill everyone!"
he yelled into the receiver.
"We don't have a vehicle. The girl drove away and isn't answering her phone."
"Shit!"
Gray slammed the phone, ending the call.
few valleys away, Rafe knelt at the track in the sand, its crisp outline indicating its extreme freshness. The droppings in front of it were still glistening with moisture. The deer's gait had changed to a relaxed meander as he'd increased the distance between himself and whatever had startled him from his lair. With a flick of his wrist, Rafe shook a cotton infant sock, sending a small white puff of the talcum powder inside into the air. The light breeze blew the powder back and slightly to his left, indicating he still had the wind in his favor. He moved into a prone position and slid his body forward so that he could see into the open valley below him. It was one of the largest meadows on Kumba, a grassy bowl hundreds of yards across that was intersected by small creeks and a few scattered trunks from ancient toppled pines that were bleached nearly white by their exposure to the sun's rays. Slowly, he pulled the strap of his binoculars, bringing them within reach. He painstakingly searched the valley through the 10x lenses, systematically searching each quadrant of ground before moving his focus to the next. 10 minutes into the exercise, he saw it. The flick of an ear. The buck had bedded behind one of the fallen pines, its body concealed by the trunk and its massive antlers blending in perfectly with the single remaining branch that jutted skyward from the tree. But for that tiny movement, Rafe never would have seen him. Finding the deer was the first step. Now he had to make a plan to work himself within range. He traced a muddy creek bed backward from near the buck's position and figured that it would give him just enough terrain to crawl beneath the deer's line of sight. If he could make his way to the creek without being spotted, and could crawl the length of it without being heard, and if the wind didn't shift to blow his stalk, he might have a shot. He rolled to one side and shrugged off his pack, taking only his bow and quiver and what little was strapped to his body. He unclipped the Motorola two-way radio from his belt and laid it on top of the pack before backing over the ledge and out of sight of the valley below. He walked bent at the waist and to the left to put him in position to move down the ridge behind the buck. It gave him the wind's full advantage and made it less likely that the deer would spot his movement in its peripheral vision. Melusi would be proud. Chapter 39. Reese took his foot off the accelerator as they approached the ranch entrance and steered the cruiser through the steel gate that was visible from the road. The truck rumbled over the welded pipes of the cattle gap, and he punched the gas. He picked up the radio mic and made his third attempt at contact. Reese, for Rafe, over. It would make sense that Rafe would have his radio turned down, assuming that he was still hunting. Reese to Kumba Base, over. He waited a few seconds before repeating the call. Reese to Kumba Base, over.
Kumba Base here, go ahead, Reese.
It was the voice of Caroline Hastings.
Kumba Base, we have an emergency. Tears on Kumba, over. I repeat, tears on Kumba.
He used the old Rhodesian vernacular for terrorist, which was a term that, as a veteran of the Bush War's home front, Caroline was more than familiar with.
Roger, Reese. We will lock down here. Over.
Is Utalivu with you? Over.
Reese asked, using the Shona nickname for Rafe, in case they were being monitored. There was a long pause.
Negative, Reese. Over.
Roger that. I'm bringing my friend to you for safekeeping. Over.
Roger.
Reese drove at the absolute limits of his and the vehicle's abilities. As he skidded the Toyota to a stop next to the main house, he saw Jonathan, Liz, Thorne, Caroline, and Annika rush to meet him. Jonathan was carrying what looked like his old wartime FAL rifle at a high port, its crude green and brown baby shit camouflage paint job still evident after nearly 3 decades. He wore his daily work attire of boots, jeans, and a western shirt, but with a faded nylon chest rig strapped across his chest. His face was alert and his eyes were bright. He was in his element. Thorne had his bolt-action deer rifle in hand. Caroline carried a classic Bruneau Model 602 in one hand, its muzzle pointed skyward with her elbow locked into her hip. She stood beside Annika protectively, a stoic look on her face indicating that
This wasn't the first time that she'd protected the family's home from armed men with bad intentions. She rushed to open the door for Katie and wrapped her with her free arm as she climbed from the SUV.
"Reese, what's happened?" Jonathan asked.
"Not sure, sir. Katie and I received a call from the CIA on our way into town. They missed us, but not by much. The information we received says this is Russian mafia, and they are here for me and for Rafe. I am so sorry.
Never mind that now, son,"
Jonathan said, taking command.
"It sounds like they're just after the boys, but you never know. Caroline, it's just like the old days. You know what to do. Thorn, Liz, you stay here. There are ARs in the gun safe and a stack of loaded magazines next to them. Grab them and keep them close, in case those bastards get in the house. Annika, Katie, get in the vault and arm yourselves. But only lock yourselves in as a last resort in case these tears try to burn you out. We'll be back as soon as we get Rafe."
All nodded in unison, and Caroline led the other women quickly toward the house.
"Hop in," Reese said. The older man nodded and opened the back door of the cruiser.
He put two fingers in his mouth and whistled loudly.
"Zulu, come!"
On cue, the family hound came bounding around the corner of the house and jumped into the SUV without hesitation. Jonathan took a seat, the muzzle of his rifle resting between his feet. As soon as he slammed the passenger door, Reese hit the gas, spitting gravel as the cruiser fishtailed down the driveway. Chapter 40. Rafe's feet were soaked and numb from stalking through the icy creek. It was the only way to stay below the buck's vision. He moved at a painfully slow pace to reduce the noise signature, the glacial stream freezing his calves. When he was within 100 yards of the deer, he set down his bow and moved carefully onto the grassy bank. He unlaced his boots and set them aside on the dry land. Ordinarily, he would have made his final stalk wearing just his wool socks, but given their saturation, he was afraid that they might make a squishing sound, betraying his presence. He removed them as well and laid them out on the stalks of grass to air dry. He pulled the knit wool cap from his head and tore a handful of vegetation from the ground. Weaving the long strands into the fabric, he transformed the simple hat into a crown of local camouflage. He was on all fours now, crawling in the long grass the way he'd watched lionesses hunt in Africa. He wondered for a moment how many men had crawled through this same valley, bow or atlatl in hand, in pursuit of deer, elk, or even mammoths. It wasn't uncommon to find the flint artifacts of hunters past when the soil on the ranch was turned over by spring rains. He pulled the powder-filled sock from his hip pocket and gave it a shake to test the wind. It was light, but holding. He slipped it away and continued his slow crawl, his bow in his right hand. He put his weight on his knuckles so as not to damage the bow as he moved. It was slow going, but now was not the time to rush. Sneaking a peek, he saw that he was 60 yards from the branches of the fallen pine. A good shooter with a compound bow could take a shot on an animal of this size from where he knelt, but with a recurve, even an archer of his talents needed to cut that figure in half. Rafe eased back into a crawl and began to close the final yards. 40 yards. He slipped an arrow from the leather-covered quiver attached to the bow's frame and carefully knocked it onto the braided bowstring. He held the bow in his left hand, his pointer finger holding the arrow securely on its rest. In 10 more yards, Rafe would rise to both knees to keep his hips on a level plane and bring the bow to full draw. The buck would stand up and Rafe would have a split second to release the shot before the animal bounded out of range. His breathing was rapid, and his mind was totally focused on the next move, the next soft spot to place his hands and knees. Despite the cool morning temperatures, rivulets of sweat ran down his face. To Rafe, there was no feeling more natural, more human, than the stalk. He wrapped two fingers of his right hand around the string and purposefully relaxed his left hand's grip on the bow. His body rose slowly but deliberately, his eyes focused on the spot where he knew the buck's shoulder would be. Rafe's head was just clearing the crest of the grass stalks when he saw the buck lurch to his feet. It was always shocking how big these animals were at close range. Rafe froze. Something had spooked the buck, but his focus was over Rafe's head, toward the ridge behind him.
The sixth sense.
Morphing from hunter to warrior in less than a second, he sprinted forward as the ground around him came alive, eruptions of dirt showering upward and the unmistakable crack of supersonic rifle rounds passing nearby. Instincts hardwired from nearly two decades of sustained combat took over. His hands released the bow as he sprinted toward the tree that had been the buck's hiding spot, the Colt coming effortlessly from its leather holster as he ran. He could hear the incoming rounds chewing into the earth around him. Halfway to the tree, he dove the remaining yards, his body going fully horizontal as it flew for the only available cover. He hit hard on his belly and knees and rolled back the way he'd come, pressing his body against the trunk of ponderosa pine. Rounds impacted the thick wood fibers, but thanks to the velocity they'd lost on their way to the target, none penetrated completely through. There was no "why me" or "why now" clogging the former commando's consciousness. Instead, he was entirely focused on prevailing. He was lying on his side, body parallel to the trunk of the tree. He turned his head to ensure that no one was moving in on the ridge behind him.
Take a breath. Look around. Make a call.
Rafe took a moment to take stock of the situation. Multiple bad guys with Kalashnikovs. He'd been shot at by them enough times to know exactly what they sounded like. No sign of a belt fed, which was good news. He hoped that they didn't have an RPG. If there was a sniper among them, he'd already be dead, which meant they probably didn't have anything more capable than AKs or AKMs. He had a handgun that was designed when Taft was in the White House. It held 7 rounds in the magazine and 1 in the chamber. 2 more magazines were stowed in a leather pouch on his belt. The ridgeline where the fire was coming from was an honest 300 yards from his position, and it was farther, almost 500, to the next ridge behind him. He was essentially in the bottom of a gigantic bowl, hiding behind one of the only available pieces of cover. It wasn't good, but it could have been worse.
It can always be worse.
The creeks, such as the one through which he had just waded, all flowed into a swampy area to his left, which would be chest-high with water at the moment. That meant that when these guys started trying to flank him, they would have to do so from his right. The volume of fire coming his way became more sporadic as his attackers began to change magazines. He could hear someone yelling in a language other than English, no doubt their leader taking command of the situation. He must have directed them to conserve ammunition because the full auto bursts were replaced with a steady stream of semi-automatic fire designed to keep him in place so that they could maneuver to make the kill. Rafe low crawled to the extreme left end of the log and slowly began to ease his way forward until he could see one of the shooters. The first figure was prone, the dust from his rifle's muzzle blast giving away his position. He continued to push himself forward with his toes as he brought his 1911 to bear, searching for a larger target at this extreme range. The third figure he spotted must have been the leader. He was up on one knee, directing the other members of the team with his left arm. Rafe was in what was known as the rollover prone position, an incredibly steady way to shoot a handgun. The distance would have been unfathomable to most shooters, but Rafe's dedication to training with the 1911 at extreme handgun ranges was about to pay off. His thumb pushed down on the safety unconsciously as his hands brought the pistol to full extension. His eyes found the serrated front sight and held it at the midway point of the target's torso, the steel blade rising halfway above the rear notch to accommodate for the distance. He exhaled deeply and trusted the area wobble of his sights, all focus on the front post, as his finger pressed evenly back against the trigger. The shot broke, and he completed his follow-through before shifting his eyes to the target in case a correction was needed. His ears registered the hollow sound of a large bullet slapping flesh, and he saw the distinctive Russian weapon drop to the ground. Reese raced down the dirt roads with both hands on the wheel, Jonathan directing him at each turn. He was familiar with the ranch, but no one knew the land the way Jonathan did. Reese could see Rafe's parked Land Rover as they came around a tight bend, and Jonathan motioned for him to stop. He rolled down the window to listen, and Reese shut off the motor. They heard the unmistakable sound of rifle fire in the distance. Jonathan considered the terrain for a moment and pointed forward on the track.
"Drive up to this ridge and drop me off.
You continue down this road and you'll likely come up on whoever is after Rafe. I know you can handle yourself."
Reese cranked the motor and sped up the incline ahead. The road took them up a ridge line that ran parallel to the direction of the gunfire. The ridge appeared to be the highest terrain feature in the area, so Reese would most likely come in above the action. Several hundred yards up the ridge, Jonathan motioned for Reese to slow down. He opened the passenger door while the cruiser was still rolling and prepared to bail out. As soon as the vehicle